One of my favorite tasks of being a senator is hosting town hall meetings. I held 39 of them my first year in the Senate, all across Illinois, in tiny rural towns like Anna, and prosperous suburbs like Naperville, in black churches on the South Side, and a college in Rock Island. There's not a lot of fanfare involved. My staff will call up the local high school, library, or community college to see if they're willing to host the event. A week or so in advance, we advertise in the town newspaper, in church bulletins, and on the local radio station. On the day of the meeting, I'll show up a half hour early to chat with town leaders and we'll discuss local issues, perhaps a road in need of repaving or plans for a new senior center. After taking a few photographs, we enter the hall where the crowd is waiting. I shake hands on my way to the stage, which is usually bare except for a podium, a microphone, a bottle of water, and an American flag posted in its stand. And then, for the next hour or so, I answer to the people who sent me to Washington. Attendance varies at these meetings. We've had as few as 50 people turn out, as many as 2,000. But however many people show up, I'm grateful to see them. They are a cross-section of the counties we visit, Republican and Democrat, old and young, fat and skinny, truck drivers, college professors, stay-at-home moms, veterans, school teachers, insurance agents, CPAs, secretaries, doctors, and social workers. They are generally polite and attentive, even when they disagree with me or one another. They ask me about prescription drugs, the deficit, human rights in Burma, ethanol, bird flu, school funding, and the space program. And as I look out over the crowd, I somehow feel encouraged. My time with them is like a dip in a cool stream. I feel cleansed afterwards, glad for the work I have chosen. At the end of the meeting, people will usually come up to shake hands, take pictures, or nudge their children forward to ask for an autograph. They slip things into my hand: articles, business cards, handwritten notes, armed service medallions, small religious objects, good luck charms. And sometimes someone will grab my hand and tell me that they have great hopes for me, but that they're worried that Washington is going to change me, and I will end up just like all the rest of the people in power. "Please stay who you are," they will tell me. "Please don't disappoint us." It's an American tradition to attribute the problems with our politics to the quality of our politicians. At times, this is expressed in very specific terms. The president is a moron, or Congressman so-and-so is a bum. Sometimes a broader indictment is issued, as in, they're all in the pocket of the special interests. Most voters conclude that everyone in Washington is just playing politics, meaning that votes or positions are taken contrary to conscience, that they are based on campaign contributions or the polls or loyalty to party, rather than on trying to do what's right. Often, the fiercest criticism is reserved for the politician from one's own ranks, the Democrat who doesn't stand for anything, or the Republican in name only. All of which leads to the conclusion that if we want anything to change in Washington, we'll need to throw the rascals out. And yet, year after year, we keep the rascals right where they are, with the re-election rate for House members hovering around 96%. Political scientists can give you a number of reasons for this phenomenon, but one that is rarely mentioned helps explain why polls consistently show voters hating Congress but liking their congressmen. Hard as it may be to believe, most politicians are pretty likable folks. Certainly, I found this to be true of my Senate colleagues. One-on-one, they made for wonderful company. I'd be hard-pressed to name better storytellers than Ted Kennedy or Trent Lott, or sharper wits than Kent Conrad or Richard Shelby, or warmer individuals than Debbie Stabenow or Mel Martinez. As a rule, they proved to be intelligent, thoughtful, and hardworking people, willing to devote long hours and attention to the issues affecting their states. I was usually struck by their basic sincerity, their desire to get things right and leave the country better and stronger, their desire to represent their constituents and their values as faithfully as circumstances would allow. So what happened to make these men and women appear as the grim, uncompromising, insincere, and occasionally mean characters that populate our nightly news? What was it about the process that prevented reasonable, conscientious people from doing the nation's business? The longer I served in Washington, the more I saw friends studying my face for signs of a change, probing me for a newfound pomposity, searching for hints of argumentativeness or guardedness. I began examining myself in the same way. I began to see certain characteristics that I held in common with my new colleagues, and I wondered what might prevent my own transformation into the stock politician of bad TV movies.